Welcome to Pastures of Plenty, a history of California farm workers. I'm your host, Luis Valdez. Did you eat your vegetables today? If you did, it's likely what you ate came from California, where it was planted, cultivated, and harvested by farm workers. Bindlestiffs, coolies, okies, cicadas, campesinos. The words evoke images of people bent over rows, far from our view.
Instead of these huddled figures that are way off in a distance, those are people. People like my grandfather, your grandfather, everybody's grandmother. People need to understand that.
On low tide, she used to take this old horse and a plow and plow the sand, and all of these clams would come up.
My grandfather came here in the 1800s.
My father, who was an immigrant from Italy, in 1923 worked these ranches.
In California, it's really clear that with very few exceptions, every immigrant group came in to the field. That's the Ellis Island of California, is the fields, the furrow, the ditch. We all come through the ditch.
People on the margins, necessary, but unknown. Their story is a fundamental piece of America's history.
The farm laborer is still one of the most exploited situations in America.
Sleeping under in a car or under the bridge, you know, wasn't really, we were kids, you know, wasn't really that bad.
They cut the wages and we don't like it.
And the current debate over illegal immigration has its roots here.
Hundreds of thousands marched in the streets of major cities like Los Angeles, Detroit, and Phoenix for the past few days.
We come together to say that we are workers, not criminals.
If they make everybody a felon, I think you can forget about getting your crops harvested anymore.
In this program, we'll hear oral histories of farm workers who came from Asia and the Philippines to harvest California's fruits and vegetables. And we'll look at some of the hard-fought and often bloody labor battles that shaped their quest for better conditions. In the 1700s, Native Americans planted California's first orchards and vineyards. After Mexico's independence in the early 1800s, most other farm workers were, by definition, Mexicans. After statehood, white settlers bought giant tracts of land from the former Spanish, now former Mexicans, and started a grain bonanza. One problem: who would help them spin all this wheat into gold? To tell this story, here is producer Rachel Ann Goodman.
The year is 1881, and the Pearl River Delta in China is racked by civil war. A sharecropper's fourth son, Chin Leung, has been told he must leave home. There is no land for him to farm, so he decides to try his luck on Gold Mountain, the shimmering promise of wealth in California.
Husband says he is going to Golden Mountain and doesn't listen to my pleas. In the still of night, full of thoughts, I cannot rest my eyes. We may become rich, but worthy is really nothing. Gold Mountain Song.
Leaving his family behind, Chin Leung borrows money from relatives and books passage on a steamship bound for San Francisco. And luck smiles on him.
When he first arrived, he actually worked in San Francisco. Then he was recruited to go to the Sacramento, Stockton area to work on a potato farm. And because he could speak enough English, he's one of the few Chinese that actually became a big farmer, and he was known as the Potato King. And he had, at one point, 500 Chinese workers, and in his best year, in 1910, he made $90,000 one year.
That's historian Judy Young, Chin Leung's great-granddaughter. By the 1870s, with a transcontinental railroad complete, many of the 75,000 Chinese in California found work in the fields. In the Sacramento Delta, they cleared swampland and built the levee system by hand. Then they planted thousands of acres of pear trees, some of which are still bearing fruit today.
I'm Wally Chan, and in Cortland. Here we are in the yard of the Chan Farms. This is our shop. It's my dad's house on the left. We're walking towards the pear trees.
Wally Chan is the third generation to farm this land. His grandfather arrived with the first big wave of Chinese farm workers to the Delta.
I don't know what made those guys do it, but somebody did it. Plant pear trees, and here they are. Yeah. Some of them are over 100 years old, and they can live a long time. My grandpa came to the United States in the late 1800s, and he settled in San Francisco. And he was a merchant. He worked in a couple of stores out there, I think, in San Francisco. And then when the earthquake came, he decided he better get out of town and come to the Delta. So in 1906, he came to the Delta. His name was Chong Chan, C-H-A-N. Then he settled here in Cortland, 1935, something like that. In the early 1930s, I think, most of the orchards here were run by Chinese, and the pears were picked by Chinese and pruned by Chinese, and it was just the Chinese labor force. But they were all like brothers, and they shared and shared alike, most of them.
This land has been farmed by the Chan family for seven decades. Back in the 30s, they sharecropped, then eventually saved enough to buy up more than 600 acres. Wally Chan has had his tough years. 2006 was one of them. Late rains have stunted some of the pears, making them unfit for harvest.
See a big old pear like this, which bloomed about a month ago. And then you have another bunch that bloomed about 2 weeks ago, which is this size. It never happened like this before. So I don't know what we're going to do. I think what we'll probably have to do is wait for a long time and just pick them one time.
A few bad years are expected for any farm, but ironically, with competition from Chinese imports, Chan says it's all he can do to resist selling out to developers.
And people ask, why are you still doing this and not making any money? I said, I don't know, that's a good question. We're an ornery breed. It's a good lifestyle.
A few miles down the Sacramento River from Chan's farm, you'll find the town of Locke. It's one of the last rural Chinatowns in the United States and on the National Register of Historic Places. You can still see the old brothels and gambling houses as you walk the narrow avenue between the whitewashed buildings. Their warped balconies lean in toward each other now, as if whispering long-forgotten secrets. Ping Li's father helped start this town back in 1913.
The unique part of this town, I guess everybody knows by now, is I think it's the only Chinese-built town for the Chinese that is left in the United States. Before, these Chinatowns were all just catering to the Chinese that was working on the farms. These are the people that comes in these Chinatowns to buy the provisions and look for a little entertainment. You got to remember, they're all single people. They have no family. They just came over here just like the Mexican help today. In Locke alone, in the streets on a pear season, you probably see 400 or 500 people around, 3-4 gambling houses. Hey, Clarence, 你今天那个 museum 开不开啊?
刚才开了就删了。哦,删了。
Longtime Locke resident Connie King, born in 1923, shows me the old gambling hall. It's now preserved as a museum, with all the old games still sitting there as if awaiting customers.
It's open. You can go and take a picture.
Sure, let's do.
Yeah, because... Hi, Carol. Each table have a different kind of games, and this is how when the men get off work, this is where they play game, and they have a...
That's where you'd cash out when you were done.
See, this is where you play lottery, see?
Uh-huh.
See, go in there.
Those are ping pong balls, and do you know what they say on them?
They have numbers on it, see?
Okay.
They have words in it, so each word come out, they mark it down, and then if you win five words that he put out, then you win so much money. See?
Like bingo.
Just being in California was gamble enough for many Chinese. When the economy cooled off in the 1870s, anti-Chinese sentiment began to heat up. Dennis Kearney, a labor organizer recently off the boat from Ireland, took it a step further. He called for the expulsion of the Chinese from the state.
California must be all American or all Chinese. We are resolved that it shall be American, and are prepared to make it so. May we not rely upon your sympathy and assistance? Dennis Kearney, San Francisco, 1879.
Historian Sandy Lydon.
The standard line was, they're taking work that others, non-Chinese, would like to have. It's that hollow argument that we hear even today. The line of people waiting to go into a swamp, right, with a pick and a shovel and a rake to turn that into arable land was very short.
California's congressional delegation pushed the Chinese Exclusion Act through Congress in 1882. It is the first legislation in U.S. history that excluded an immigrant group based on race, and it wasn't repealed until 1952. Historian Judy Young.
These were the immigrants and the laborers that helped develop the agricultural economy that made California the premier green state. And they probably would have stayed in agriculture and continued to help make the lands productive if it wasn't for the Chinese Exclusion Act.
Back in the town of Locke, more than a century later, a small gesture of restitution is underway. Connie King, now 84, has spent her whole life fighting to save the town from the wrecking ball.
So I told the board of supervisors that I'd like to save the town, you know, and then so they asked me, what do you want us to do about it? And I said, I'd like to have that town preserved in memory of those Chinese worked so hard to get California started, see? So they talked for a while, they voted, and then they said they will help us. So finally, in 2004, December 11, 2004, we finally get the land after I wait 55 years. I was the happiest person in town. In fact, I raised up my hand, and I yell up to heaven, and I tell those people up there that passed away, I said, you come on down and help us celebrate.
I want to put Chinese into the public historical record. I want people to have an understanding that Chinese have begun immigrating since the gold rush, and they've been here for generations. They are part of America.
Though the Chinese helped turn horticulture in the state into a multi-million dollar industry, the door to this country was slammed in their faces. With the Chinese dwindling, the ag industry looked elsewhere for workers. Coming up, how Japanese immigrants fared in the fertile fields of California. Right after this short break, you're listening to Pastures of Plenty. I'm Rachel Ann Goodman. This is Pastures of Plenty, a history of California farm workers. The next part of our story is called From the Land of the Rising Sun to the Land of the Sun-Kissed Orange. A few miles downriver from the Chinatown of Locke, Walnut Grove stands as a reminder that Japanese farm workers came to California in great numbers too. On a quiet Sunday, Eugene Phillips is restoring the old Miyazaki bathhouse.
So originally you would walk down this pathway here between the buildings, and this was then the entrance door to the side to the bathhouse here. And you see there's a stairway going upstairs, which was to the boarding house. Like there would be maybe 1,000 workers would come in on the weekends, and you know, this would be where they would bathe and party and go to religious services. Just imagine a line of people waiting outside, paying, getting their towels, coming in, getting undressed, going to the first wash off, the rinse off, and in the tub, maybe being in the tub, 15 minutes, and then they would hop out and you'd have this cycle of people, maybe, 100 people a day would come through and bathe.
So the Japanese immigrants brought hot tubs to California.
Naoko Kawamura. The time I come here was in 1947, and I went to barber school and served all these farmers haircuts, It used to be we all went to the bathhouse. Just like we, in a bathrobe, walk across, go to, and then chat with the people in there. While we're all soaking.
And I see you have two clocks. Is one Japan time and the other American time?
No. They're broken.
Oh.
And one, I have three of them. They all stop working, so it just stayed there.
So time really has stood still here in more ways than one. See if this quote sounds familiar.
California, which is fast becoming the granary of the world, demands labor. It demands cheap labor. Colonel F.A.B., attorney.
Today, we hear the same thing said about Mexican farm workers. 100 years ago, the Japanese started coming to California to fill a farm labor vacuum created when the U.S. banned Chinese immigration. Historian Sandy Lydon.
There are moments of snapshot in the 1900 census where you've got, in 1910, where you've got crews of 50 and 60-year-old Chinese men working alongside crews of 20-year-old Japanese. And they very quickly took their place.
Back in the 1930s, Frank Kazuo Oshita and his father worked for the Spreckel Sugar Company in the beet fields around Salinas. Kazuo is now 87 years old.
I was born in Castroville, March 6, 1920. My father came from Hiroshima, Japan. The workforce doing the agricultural labor was all Japanese and mostly all single men. They had difficulties making ends meet because not enough work for them.
Back then, Frank worked with a short-handled hoe that made him stoop over all day. Beet thinning and harvesting was seasonal work, and it took skill.
You gotta single them out. You can't leave a big gob. My dad was saying when he first came to this country, it was about from nickel to a dime an hour. By the time I got started, it was about 25 cents.
The major accomplishment for California's Japanese was moving out of the ditch and into land ownership. Unlike the Chinese, the Japanese did it with the help of their wives, says historian Sandy Lydon.
Probably the biggest difference is going to be the presence of families. Japanese families are here, and that gets them to move quickly from that farm labor status into the farmer status. By virtue of immigration laws and by the Gentleman's Agreement 1907-1908, Japanese will start bringing their wives.
Under a gentleman's agreement between the U.S. and Japan, Japan stopped issuing passports for male workers, but let women and children emigrate. A Japanese farm worker would often arrange for a mail order bride, never having seen his intended until she got off the ship. That's how Kei Kitako Izumizaki's parents met each other.
My mother was Matsue. And my father was Yomoya Tsuda, T-S-U-D-A. Well, my father came here first from the Shikoku Island and the county of Ehime-ken. And my mother comes from the same part of that country also. They both came over by boat. I know my father never talked about it, but I remember my mother talking about how terrible it was to come steerage. But I remember his talking about, borrowing the horse and wagon and going after my mother and then driving her back. And she was being impressed to think that the horse and wagon was his. And as he rode close by the house. This is the boss's house. You know, oh, what a lovely place. And then keeps on going to the, you know, like the chicken coop-like place, you know, where they all, but that was the way it was.
30 miles north of Watsonville is the area that once proudly bore the name the Valley of Heart's Delight for its expanses of orchards and vineyards, the Santa Clara Valley. Here, hard by the freeway, one of the last remnants of Japanese-owned farms sits surrounded by Silicon Valley high-rises. Jim Kawasaki inherited this place from his stepfather, Eiichi Sakawe.
And we're in San Jose, on the H.J. Edwards Sakawe farm.
And who is Mr. Sakawe?
He is the oldest son of the original purchaser of the property. He was from Japan, immigrated. He worked on various farms and things like that, and saved his money, and sent for his wife, picture bride, and they married here, and then he continued to save his money. And then when Eiichi was born, being that the first generation, or Issei's, could not purchase property, as soon as the son was born, he started looking into purchasing the property under his son's name. And so they bought this property here. It was, I think, 5 acres originally. Used to be primarily a truck farm. They grew vegetables, lettuce, and other crops. And then, about World War II time frame, they started planting some fruit trees. Those trees back there with the some of the yellow tips, those are persimmon trees.
And you got walnuts there?
Yeah.
Pomegranate?
Yes. Couple of pomegranates.
Can I try it?
Go ahead.
Mmm.
Yeah, no.
That is so good.
Yeah. It's all organic. He did not believe in spraying for bugs or anything else.
That's delicious.
So I've been, you know, just trying to keep it in some semblance of working order.
Developers have offered Jim Kawasaki millions for his land, but he's turned them all down. Maybe he's holding on to it in memory of his ancestors who fought hard for the right to own land. Historian Sandy Lydon.
You can often tell what's going on in California by what they write laws against. There were no alien land laws until 1913. And the alien land law in California in 1913 was directed specifically at the Japanese.
The state's alien land law made it illegal to sell to anyone not eligible for citizenship, and that meant most immigrants from Asia. This man, who is now retired from a life of farming celery and berries in San Jose, says his family got creative.
My name is John Y. Hayakawa. I was born in San Francisco on April the 2nd, 1918. Hooray, my 88th birthday. When I realized I was alive, I guess I was 3 or 4. That's all I saw was orchard and farm, orchard and farm. I didn't know San Jose existed other than this Japantown, huh? And we were sharecropping till I was 17. And one of the times my father hit it big gambling. He bought a secondhand car, huh? Well, that's a sideline. There was a Caucasian attorney by the name of Peckham in San Jose. And he said, if your child is born in the United States, even though he's not 21, he's of legal stature to buy. So that was one loophole, huh? And people bought.
Did he put some land in your name?
On the contract, I signed it, yes, because he couldn't. They liked this bleached celery. Oh, we made potfuls of money. December 1939, my dad bought me a new car. Oh, I was happy. It was a 1940 four-door Super Deluxe, the best thing on the road. Huh? Had a radio and everything.
In the back of the San Jose Japanese American Museum, John Hayakawa shows me a planting cart his wife once used in the berry fields.
Would you believe this is my wife's picking cart?
She wheeled it along, huh?
Well, the buggy wheel I had to replace because the pine wheels, you know, it's always moist and it fell apart.
Mr. Hayakawa's practiced hands demonstrate how an old hand-wheeled cedar works.
Every time this wheel turns, see, it drops a seed. Oops, it's tight. Oh, no. There. Watashi wa ichigo no oyakusho yatte imashita keredo, kore kurai erai shigoto wa arimasen. Meaning, I've been in the strawberries for a long time, but there's nothing like strawberries and hard work.
My name is Jim Yamaichi, born and raised here in San Jose, the area called Berryessa. They call it East San Jose today. That's my home base as I grew up as a farm boy. So I did my lion's share of work.
There were 10 kids?
10 kids, yeah.
And what number are you?
Number 4. And I'm number 4. So.
And when were you born?
1922. We used to pick anise when it rains, and they had to pack that out. And once each one of those crates weighs like 85 to 90 pounds, put that on your back and with boots on and with mud, and you're walking down the furrows. That and carrying out the cabbage was just to kill us. You know, as a youngster, you know, you're only 15, 16 years old, and you're putting 100 pounds on your back and walk slushing through, you know.
Sometimes there was too much work, even for a family of 12, so the Yamaichis hired Filipino laborers during the Depression years.
It was 1932, 33. We had Filipino workers working on the farm because we couldn't handle it all. And at the time, the Filipino workers were getting 11.5 cents an hour. And they were striking for 1.5 cents an hour to 13 cents an hour. They said, Yamaichi, you could afford to pay it. I said, we can't. So 5 of us will work 2.5 days and we'll pick 200 boxes of cucumber. And now 200 boxes at 5 cents, how much is it? 2.5 days, 5 people working, $10. Later on in the years, this Filipino person come to me and say, Jimmy, your father could have paid that 1.5 cents. He was still moaning about that 1.5 cents to wait all these years. 70 years later, he still talk about it.
Doing the math, the Yamaichi family was only making 8 cents an hour each. By the late 1930s, though, things were looking up for the Japanese farmers of California. Some had cornered the market on strawberries and raspberries, while others, like the Hayakawas, had become kings of bleached celery. Then, on December 7th, 1941, Japan attacked Pearl Harbor.
Naturally, in celery, you start your seedbed in February, weather permitting. And with Pearl Harbor, we're waiting for the other shoe to drop. There's rumors of digging a trench and putting us in there and getting, you know, just like the Jews suffered in Europe. And the elder generation really panicked, you know, that's going to happen. I says, no.
On February 19th, 1942, Executive Order 9066 gave the military the right to remove all people of Japanese ancestry from the coast, regardless of citizenship.
They say, well, we give you 2 weeks to get everything in order and so you can move out, you know. You lived all your life in California, and then all of a sudden they're telling you that, well, that you're no more a citizen of the country. When you come down to it, what could we do, you know? They took everything away from us.
By the spring and summer, 120,000 people were sent to 10 camps spread out from Manzanar in the California desert to Heart Mountain in Wyoming.
And they drove us to the desert, to a place called Manzanar.
Only those evacuees whose statements and whose acts leave no question of their loyalty to the United States are permitted to leave.
Though we saw no apple tree, only rows of prison berries.
Yeah, 28 guard towers like this around us. And we had a warning, regular fence here and a warning fence here. So if you cross this area here, they can shoot you without no problem.
Did anyone try to escape?
How far would you get?
In 1944, Kitako Azumizaki got a letter at the camp in Poston, Arizona, granting her release. At first, she was ecstatic to be returning home and planned to resume berry farming with her new husband, James, just back from the war.
People in every color costume, people from all of the nations of the world have assembled here today to celebrate this truly great victory over the Japanese.
You'd be so nice to come home to. You'd be so.
I always wanted to come back to Watsonville, but I think less than half the people really came back here. And one day I decided, well, I'll just go and say hi to my old school teacher. And she looked at me and asked, why did you come back, you know? And I thought, oh boy, you know, that's how much the prejudice was bad around here.
Jim Kawasaki remembers a similar homecoming.
In Salinas, my father had a home, and so he just locked the house up and left, you know, a lot of things in there. And when he came back after the war, there was a family in there. And he went up and said, this is my house. The guy says, try to get me out of here. He went and complained to the sheriff. The sheriff laughed at him.
After the war, many children of Japanese immigrants who had college degrees could not find jobs and so returned to farming, albeit in a more competitive environment.
The established agricultural industry in California was relieved when the Japanese went to camp. They took advantage of it.
I think one of the biggest things that you had to tell the American public, 1% was controlling almost 50% of one industry, and then that was one of the biggest things that made them put us away because they want to break us.
So when the Japanese came back from camp, the Japanese strawberry growers, they found themselves completely at a disadvantage. The Growers and Shippers Association of Salinas was one example of a growers association that had taken a very strong position once the Japanese were removed for the government not to allow them to come back after the war. But they did it under the cloak of patriotism.
David Mas Masamoto stayed in the family peach business near Fresno, California. Here he is, reading from his book, Harvest Sun.
Good pruning is not a science. It's the art of working with a living entity, an annual sojourn to a familiar place with the intention of returning the next year and the year after that. But it goes beyond just the physical structure of a vine. The ghosts of many pruners live before me in my fields. This is a place where generations reside.
By the 1940s, California agriculture had become big agribusiness with its vast appetite for cheap labor. In the 1950s, it would look to Mexico for workers, but for now, it continued leaning on the strong backs of one group who had been there, it seemed, from the beginning, the Filipinos. Coming up on Pastures of Plenty, Filipinos in the Fields, right after this break.